My name is Justin Staples, and my black is transnational.
You are listening to Season 5 of My Dad's Podcast, My Black is Transnational, a podcast about blackness and reconnecting back to our native homeland. Find us wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Check us out on YouTube. You can follow us on Instagram or blacktransnational.com. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of My Black is Transnational. My name is Dr. Kalechi Bay Lamberts. And on this episode, I have a conversation with Mr. Justin Staples, former NFL player, current president of the Illinois chapter of the NFL Players Association. We talk about his experience as a player and his perceptions in regards to culture, blackness, sports, and where the NFL is going in terms of the presence of Africa and African immigrants or second generation African immigrants in the sport. Can the NFL be transnational? But before we get into that, let's go through our formalities. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, you can find this podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. Please be sure to rate, review, and leave a comment for us so that we can be able to continue to tailor this podcast for your listening ears. You can find this podcast also on social media. Follow us on Instagram at Black Transnational Podcast. Follow me, the host, at Black Transnational _. You can also follow us on Facebook with the same name, Black Transnational Podcast. And you can also check out our website at www.blacktransnational.com. There's a one-stop shop for everything you need to know about the podcast. You can binge seasons past there. You can learn more about the guests. You can even inquire about being a guest on the show as well. So where do I begin? Justin Staples and I are really good friends. We met in grad school, and I've been a huge supporter of his as he got drafted into the NFL, the National Football League. For those who are international, this is the American football, all right? Not the real football, as you all would call it. But here in football in America, he was drafted to play at a professional level with the Cleveland Browns, which is his hometown team, and also play for the Tennessee Titans. And so we talk about his experience as a former NFL player, but also talking about his experience now and how he took his playing experiences into more administrative leadership positions post-career. And we talk about just how his upbringing, his cultural values, the things he learned in the locker room all influence how he perceives blackness and how he constructed his black identity. And how did the NFL locker room foster his or even enhance his black perceptions and attitudes when it comes to black cultural identity? We talk about transnationalism from his perspective as an African-American man and what that looks like in terms of connecting with Africa. We talk about how the NFL is becoming more expansive and becoming more transnational with the influence of African players. We see what Jeremiah Owusu-Koramoah is doing with the Cleveland Browns. We see what David Njoku is doing with the Cleveland Browns for Nigeria and Ghana, respectively, with JOK. And so we talk about what that is and how the international pathways being created by this sport is becoming an opportunity for more black players to become connected to Africa, and how players who are children of immigrants are utilizing this platform to now make Africa more marketable. We talk about that among so many other things in terms of fatherhood, in terms of college, in terms of racism, and so much more. It's a very rich conversation. I think you all will enjoy just how brilliant and intelligent Justin is, and just how passionate he is for not just the work he does, but for the people he serves as a leader. And so I hope you all enjoy this conversation as much as I did. And I hope that there's more of these conversations to come, especially for me, who's an avid sports fan. So in addition to looking at transnationalism in terms of health, I think, you know, this podcast is expanding in terms of how we go about applying the concept of transnational in various fields and various areas. So, without any further ado, here's my conversation with Mr. Justin Staples. Enjoy. What's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of My Black is Transnational. And I have on the show today someone that has been long overdue to be on this show. And so it is a pleasure to have on here Justin Staples, the first former retired NFL linebacker from the Cleveland Browns. Also played with the Tennessee Titans. I think that was the first team. You know, currently the president of the NFLPA Illinois chapter. Most importantly, a father and an alumni, right? And, you know, shout out to the brothers of Omega Psi Phi fraternity, Poisonous Pi Psi, right? So good brother of mine on the show, man. Welcome to the show, Justin, man. Thank you so much for joining.
Yes, sir. Appreciate you, Kills. So, Dr. Ebay Nanny. Appreciate you, brother, man. Far too gracious, man. Feel blessed to be able to be here, just to see the growth from when we first met to now, man. It's amazing.
Yeah.
That's definitely a testament to the hard work that's been put in place, man.
Yeah.
Good to be associated with a brother like yourself.
Thank you. Thank you, bro. Yeah, man. I remember that class, man. I remember seeing you in class, man, doing your thing, bro, and to see the evolution, bro. You know, but we're going to talk about that evolution and how you got to where you're at and the things that inspire you. But before we get into that, I always want to give my guests the opportunity to be able to also introduce themselves and talk a little bit about themselves, especially culturally, like where are you from? Where do you represent? What are the things that mean to you as a black man?
Yeah, man. I mean, shoot, we can get on that for a long tangent, going that for hours. What it means, especially organizationally, how I've been able to implement some of the values I was raised with in this cultural space. Mm-hmm. But yeah, as you mentioned, I guess we'll start and work backwards. Right now, currently functioning as the Chicago chapter NFLPA president, and it just is an extension of that organizational involvement that I always sought to seek and hold myself accountable for. What it functions as is our union for former players. So there's an entity and a piece of working towards the resources and benefits, making sure that former players, regardless of tenure, be it 0 years, once invested and beyond, players know what is out there for them in that transition beyond the game. As we know, it's been well documented, the financial woes that professional athletes face, and with especially football being demographically dominated by black men, it's something that I saw again as a calling for myself to be in this space and be able to function as a person that can kind of get people past generational downfalls. Mm-hmm. I am from a football family. My mm-hmm. father had the fortune as well for playing in the 80s with under Dennis Green in Northwestern. Then he transferred back home to play at University of Missouri. He's from St. Louis. And then he had a real quick stint with the Seattle Seahawks himself. So just seeing that generation and seeing him at the point of that lack of access to resource and benefits, which I know ultimately led to his early death at 48 years old. Again, it was a calling for myself to make sure that other generations of players aren't facing that same transition, not knowing, not having access, being so specialized in sport that we were so fortunate enough to play for so long, and be able to, again, find their place post the game and be taken care of for what they have contributed to an entity like the NFL, man. We know the billions and billions that are generated. We got the Super Bowl coming up, which that's about to be a billion-dollar event in and of itself, like it is every single year.
Yep.
So it's only right that the actors in that entity are taken care of no matter where their tenure lands them post the game. Mm-hmm. And I just feel fortunate to be called to be in a position to kind of talk on that a little bit. So, yeah, obviously I wouldn't be able to be a part of the NFLPA without my background in the NFL, as you mentioned, with the Cleveland Browns and the Tennessee Titans. Actually started off in Cleveland first, which is a homecoming for me and of myself there. Chicago and Cleveland are always considered. I was born here in Chicago. I was raised in Cleveland, though, so it's my two hometowns. And especially playing my high school ball in Cleveland once we moved over there, seeing the love and the affinity for football that Ohio has, it left its mark on me. It was a way to culturally connect with other black men in the area all across the west side of Cleveland, which we were sparse demographically compared to the east side, eastern half of the city. And as well as just be able to lead and just be at the forefront and whatever school you were at, man, it was just crazy. It's a whole following that obviously the South gets its billing. You get the Friday Night Lights movies and all that stuff. But I always want to give a testament to Ohio football because it's the same field out there. And, yeah, like I said, born here in Chicago, mother's family's from here. always found myself coming back, which is how I ended up at the University of Illinois post my high school career. Mm-hmm. Loved my tenure down there, man. Great times. Obviously was gotten involved, and that's where my community outreach, I guess, really started beyond football. Mm-hmm. As you mentioned, we have our Divine Nine connection, with me being a brother of Omega Psi Phi Fraternity Incorporated, Phi Psi Chapter. And it just molded me. Again, I'm a legacy there. So it was something that I saw the good pieces of my father and what he left behind for me. And I plan to implement that on my family going forward. You mentioned I'm a father, and really all this stuff is a testament to seeing my place as a Black man in society and how I can lead and be a bridge builder for my son and the generations behind me. So, man, it's a blessing to be here, blessing to be associated again with brothers like yourself, that you're able to model off of, see what it's like moving in today's society. It's we're obviously coming into new levels, new devils, essentially, new access, new barriers, essentially, that have been broken. Now we're being able to shape the world and mold, especially American society, unlike previous generations have in the workforce, mainly is what I'm getting at. And it's a unique position, and it's a great time to be alive, and a great time for us to leave our mark, I think.
Absolutely, bro. And you know what I'm hearing from everything you just shared with us is that, bro, like, it's personal. And I mean, and not in a negative way, right? But it's all these things that inspire your steps are personally tied to all the things that shape your identity, right? From your connection to Chicago to Ohio, and I mean Cleveland specifically. Well, that does lead me to ask, then, what's your connection with St. Louis, right? I mean, you said that's
where your father's home. Yeah,
right. That's your father's side, right? But I'm saying, like, how connected are you? Have you, did you visit there? Have you ever?
Oh yeah, definitely. And with that, just coming from the demographic that we do, I have an extended family. My siblings live there as well, and I'm always down there, man. My baby brother, he's playing. He's going into his senior year of football. At actually the same high school as Jeremy Macklin, guy that played for University of Missouri during our era. Played with the Chiefs. We're about to be in the Super Bowl, as well as with the Eagles. He's actually the head coach at my little brother's high school.
Wow.
It's called Kirkwood.
Yeah, Kirkwood.
Kirkwood High School out there in Kirkwood, Missouri. So, definitely love to get down there, catch his games out. Like I said, got family in the area. Seeing the elder generations always is something that's a pleasure to get down there and be able to reconnect with the roots there. Sports-wise, always had an affinity for the Cardinals. The sports franchise is out of St. Louis, man. When we were kids, the greatest show on turf.
The Rams. Yeah.
Kurt Warner era, Torrey Holt, Isaac Bruce, all those guys. It was crazy to watch that. I'm going to say, man, was really my molding and exposure to football, because I think that was what they won the Super Bowl in 99, 2000, ironically enough, over the Titans. And I think that was like the first real Super Bowl that I could remember.
Me too.
I watched from start to finish.
Me too, bro.
You know, I was involved. Like,
me too.
I remember the Broncos winning a couple years before that and stuff. Like, I remember that era vaguely,
but it wasn't as clear. Super Bowl, it wasn't as clear.
It wasn't as clear as it was then.
Me too.
Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
I remember, bro. So it's crazy. I mean, just to talk about my background, right? Like, that was the first. So coming from Nigeria, came in 1997, December. But I was really, when I immigrated, I spent my first few months in the country in New York. I was in Staten Island, one of my uncles. And the first football game I saw was 98 Super Bowl. That was the Broncos. That was Elway's last year. I think it was Broncos and Packers. Broncos and Packers, right? And so I didn't understand what was going on. I just remember, like, who's this dude, John Elway? I mean, like, my memory of John Elway was him winning MVP and riding off into the sunset in his career. But my first true understanding of, like, the Super Bowl was that St. Louis and Tennessee, that last, at the end of the game, that last tackle, that everybody remembers. And so that was when I really, because for me, American football, at least that's how it was described, we didn't really know what it was about from coming from where I'm from. You know, for us, football is soccer, right? And that's what the world knows as football. Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I was learning the game of football, my first initial impression was just from what I would see in cartoons as a kid, you know, they always have this animation of dude piling up on you when you had a football. So in my mind, I'm like, this game is just hella rough, right? Like, I ain't, you know. So my initial impression, basketball, when I came to the city, I tell people all the time, people think it's funny, I thought Chicago was called the Chicago Bulls. Like, that's what I thought. That's just how dominant they were as a brand. I came to the country, and the first thing I asked in the city when I was in the car driving to my apartment, my OG was like, "Is this place called Chicago Bulls?" And they were like, "What?" I was like, "Oh, so it's not." I was like, "So is the cap? Where's Michael Jordan?" Right, like in my mind. I'm just right, like, so yeah. So you know, and then of course everything else. My love for sports continued to grow the longer I got acculturated here. But back to you and your story. And you mentioned everything in terms of like even all the way down to fatherhood and the things that inspire you and the things that motivate you. And we're gonna talk about that too. But I want to know from you, like. And you talked about being a black man and how, you know, the sport that you love is dominated by black men. But when did you realize, like, what stage in your life coming up did you realize that, one, I'm a black boy, I'm a black man, and two, like, the impact, the plight, whatever the case may be, what comes with being a black man playing sports? You mentioned your dad and, you know, him playing the sport, but him not having access to these resources and things like that. But, like, when did you get really clear understanding about your blackness and your identity as a black man, and how did that manifest in everything that you continue to do?
I didn't have the blinders up, fortunately enough, due to my father's experience in the sport. So he was one of those men. Again, he's Omega, just like myself. He was there first, but he made sure to never, even despite the distance physically that we had, never leave me with a lacking of understanding of my place in this society as a black man, and being obviously your parents see your potential in you far before it manifests in your own mind. Mm-hmm. So just knowing the track and seeing it essentially laid out for me before I even walked it, he wanted to make sure that I was prepared for certain situations, knowing especially as athletically gifted as I was, especially at an early age. He knew it would be important to kind of leave me with some of those lessons. Mm-hmm. So we spoke on things like him being in a black fraternity at a PWI, mm-hmm. and how his double identity as a football player allowed him to have certain advantages that other members of the Divine Nine community didn't have, mm-hmm. Access to certain parts of the, especially University of Missouri campus, out there in Columbia, Missouri, mm-hmm. in the 80s, which was a vastly different place than what's, you know, politically acceptable today. Mm-hmm. And knowing how beyond all that, it still meant nothing if he didn't play the game that was laid out in front of him. Mm-hmm. One of his main thing was, and something that he wanted to make sure that I was more open to when it came to just the internal workings of the business of football, and how, especially when you're on that scholarship at a major Power Five institution like the University of Missouri, like the University of Illinois, there's a piece of, for lack of better words, ownership that the university has behind the athlete, especially prior to now we're seeing this NIL era, yeah, and a little, yeah, bit more autonomy, yeah, of the athlete, and they're able to control and at least take a little piece of their earnings, more so than previous generations have ever been had. Yeah. And I just want that to keep growing. But with the sense of, okay, well, you're here on a free ride, you're here taking advantage of the scholarship dollars, therefore you have to conform to the system of what we, and where it manifests for him mainly was when it came to his time to enter into the NFL. He had a certain agent that was laid out in front of him from the booster base of University of Missouri at the time.
Okay.
And he wasn't in following with that particular branding for whatever reason. He just didn't really click. He wanted to go a different direction. Mm-hmm. And it completely derailed his opportunities being slated, and just seeing, obviously we know, we see Mel Kiper, Tom Mache every single year, they come out with the draft boards.
Right.
And they're essentially able to bolster an athlete's brand and presence and almost sway some of the decision making to a certain degree of the NFL organizations. But however, when it's that old boys club, it's the, you know, playing ball situation, is when people are on one accord and it's communicated that certain athletes are labeled a bad actor. They're labeled uncoachable. Yeah. They're labeled whatever the negative connotation may be. Yeah. Again, they can completely change and derail the course of your future based on you not conforming to what they had laid out for you in that path. So that's where that first conversation really started for him and I. Him giving me that understanding, him, again, I think, seeing and wanting to impart that knowledge on me, especially at an early age due to the distance that we had physically, and with me being and in the era I was in, I went to a powerhouse, extremely enjoyed my time there, made some of my lifelong friendships within those walls. However, it is Irish Catholic college preparatory high school. And at the time, I would firmly bet that the only Black students at the school, we were all athletes of some regard, some fashion or something form. And it just played out that way because there were a few, there was a handful that were specialized in other pockets of the school's community. However, all boys, Irish Catholic High School, like I said, on the west side of Cleveland, there were certain things that I was going to come across regardless of, you know, again, how athletically gifted I was. So, you know, you are getting articles written about you and you're bringing school notoriety, which brings its own preferential treatment. I can't lie, within the hierarchy of the school, especially from the alumni base and people that were, you know, in positions of decision making within the school, which in turn can obviously breed envy, can breed, you know, mumbling amongst the general body base. Now, when you bring that back in mind, what the racial demographic was there, it's a lot of us versus them type mentality that you're going on when within your own walls, let alone what you're dealing with, you know, through the sport arena. I played football and basketball throughout high school. So, you know, wherever the case may be. So that, again, was something that I think that I was fortunate enough to not have my blindness up against. Being that I had my father in my backing and in my corner, I was very conscious of certain conversations and certain connotations that were left on comments and remarks, be it from faculty, be it from peers at my high school. And I think that's definitely where, personally, that manifestation as a Black man in this space, even at a young age of 14, I knew what it meant to be strong in my cultural understanding and be firm in that, not be swayed into a position of, you know, this is a downtrodden position or wherever the case may be. But being, again, that leader and the person that can communicate and convey the message of at least the people around me. I never will say I'm speaking for the whole community, but, you know, the people around me and how we're seeing our place and what's going on with this. And we obviously know how sport in the American structure, it varies from the world structure. You know, you look at the soccer, the football world, globally, there's the academy faction that takes the athlete essentially away from the schooling system, gives private schooling while you're pursuing that athletic track. And the business piece is kind of localized amongst that. In the American system, we have the collegiate system, we have the high school athletic system, and the waters are kind of muddied where the athletics generate the revenue for the institution, therefore now get placed in certain hierarchies because of the business of the entire entity. And just to put it into plain words, seeing how the Rose Bowl in 2007 led directly to the building of the Ark, it led directly to the building of Grand Hall, it led to the renovations of a few other entities that were right there. And another piece that I always pay attention to is if you go back and you look at the University of Wisconsin, was in danger. University of Wisconsin Madison, the largest campus, was in danger of closing their doors throughout COVID, the 2020 year, if they didn't play the football season, because they were going to potentially lose $100 million in revenue.
Yes. Yes.
Now, yes. You cannot say anybody that's been in business that it doesn't now create a certain element with how athletics are going to be viewed within the entity of the school when it's that important just for 8 games, I think they were able to play.
Mm-hmm.
So 4 home games locally, and you couldn't even have a crowd. So it's like those, the contracts that come with it from marketing, the dollars that are committed through the Big Ten, for example, in our case, just for people having success in, you know, Ohio State goes to a BCS or a CFP bowl game, Illinois benefits from that because mm-hmm. the Big Ten gets paid for it. And it's just, it's so many things that when you really pay attention, when you really pay attention from that Black athlete perspective, then it's like you, I don't know, me personally, like I said, I felt the calling to have that understanding at a young age, and I've been working and building on it ever since.
Yeah. Yeah, bro. No, you just triggered me with that, with the arc. Because, you know, it took me a long time. It took me a long time to connect the dots. I really was just like, school just got money. I didn't even realize, right? Like,
nope. This is a one bowl game.
Yeah.
All of that.
Yeah. Man. Wow. And, you know, so, you know, when I think about it, and I'm, as you were describing these things, and I want to talk a little bit about, before we get into the diasporic aspect of things, I want to speak a little bit more about this idea in terms of your Blackness and just understanding things, the reality of it. When you are in college, you have these different teammates, and like you said, you being and your father kind of laying the blueprint out for you in terms of being able to understand the dynamic of what happens when you're an athlete, but also part of a social service organization like Omega Sci-Fi, and being able to now kind of move about different aspects of campus and wear different hats, right? As a student leader in different perspectives, not just on a team, but also with your organization. And there is that divide, bro. Like you know the divide. It exists between frats and athletes. And that's how, unless you're part of both, which at U of I, it wasn't often that happened. So being able to experience that. And I want to speak on, like, were you teammates with the Craig? Lord, the bro that passed away in Alabama a couple years ago.
Oh, Glenn Foster.
Glenn. Yes. I said Craig. Glenn. Yeah. Glenn Foster. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Not only was I teammates with him, man, we played all 5 years.
Exactly.
Together, bro. We came in together. Yeah. That's 2008.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I thought about that, and I think about. Mm-hmm. When you talk about playing outside, like outside of the field, right? The relationships that you build with these dudes that you become teammates with, how real is that? Especially the Black ones, right? Like, how tight are these relationships and connections that you have with these players in college that you're going on the field with playing? You know, you are pretty much setting the path for your professional lives. You're sharing your dreams together. I want to know what that relationship was like. And I also want to know what that reaction was like when we heard about Glenn's, you know, passing and what that did for you.
Yeah, man. Well,
if you don't mind talking about it, I don't want to.
I definitely love to honor a man like Glenn Foster and the person that he was, the father that he was, the husband that he was. Man, it's funny because we were actually just talking about this in my office the other day. There's no way to recreate that locker room aspect that we had, especially collegiately. Mm-hmm. As you know, being a broke college student, you make your fun out of anything. Yeah. You can rent out a barn, for example, and throw a party in a barn like y'all used to. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And you can just find ways to be creative, to really enjoy the time with those around you. And it's no different within the athletic structure, especially speaking on a large athletic structure like the football team.
Yeah.
So being that we were so vast in numbers for an athletic organization, you're able to bring together a lot of people from different regions of the world. So for me, the piece that was so enjoyable about that was seeing the truth behind the fact that being Black and being a Black American especially isn't a monolith, because we're portrayed as such in so many different arenas of media. You kind of lose sight of the cultural differences demographically based off of, you know, what pocket of the country that you come from. So being able that I had Haitian descended teammates that were still viewed as Black Americans because they have been here for a couple of generations, and you know their family comes up and visits, and they're making conch fritters and stuff. Having you know Nigerian descended teammates that mothers are coming in and bringing all the you know jollof and different cultural dishes from there in that arena was great. And then also seeing you know being with my teammates from DC and them in Mambo sauce and learning about that. Yeah. And hearing them talk about it for generations, and then all of a sudden, this is like you actually tried, and it's like, man, this ain't nothing but mild sauce, which y'all on. And it's like, it's seeing those differences, you know, across the diaspora, but then again, amongst ourselves, we didn't have as many like Californian teammates in college, but I did so in the pros, and just the differences in vernacular, and just hearing this, the way each other talk and stuff like that, it's just funny, kind of like, you know, jabbing against each other and just really getting to know each other and just seeing how beyond the differences as well, how, you know, how many similarities glaringly there were. And really the understanding when you get to have the unique conversations with those who are, you know, like-minded when it comes to seeking understanding of our position culturally as Black Americans, especially, and those that had, you know, done some of the same, like similar research, trying to look through their families, trace their roots and do stuff like that. Yeah. And we're having conversations on things like that, man, and finding connections, obviously knowing through the transatlantic slave trade, we're all going to have some correlation back to the Southeastern United States and the plantations and stuff that are down that way. And really just being at that unique age of coming into that understanding, you know, you're 18 to 22, a lot of self-discovery. And, man, just setting up those lifelong friendships.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, man, a person like Glenn, getting to know him and see him, you know, in the locker room, in the football aspect, all that he was athletically gifted enough to be able to, I mean, the man was a freak of nature when it came to on the football field. And then also getting to know the man outside of football.
Off the field,
he was always a life of the party.
Yes,
man.
He
always,
was. He's a legend.
That's another thing.
He's
man.
A U of I legend, bro.
Dances. Yes.
U of I legend.
Music is no lacking of the importance of music as that connector for us. Again, across regions, because one thing that Glenn mastered was being able to do every dance, no matter if it was Atlanta dance,
he was a legend.
New York dance. Of course, he had all the Chicago down.
Yep.
You know, he was always, like you said, a legend, a life of the
he
party,
a
man.
Legend.
And to have a person like that, again, we played, we redshirted together, and then we had our subsequent 4 years after that, totaling 5 years down in Champaign together, to see the growth of the man, to see him eventually go on to again become a husband and a father. Three or four young, beautiful girls that he has. And that loss, man, it's something that still sits heavy whenever we're amongst each other, amongst, you know, we have a former teammate, Kevin Mitchell, that's now the director of the Varsity Association, the Alumni Association for U of I. And he's doing a great job of bringing guys back from our era. And every time we're together, man, it's coming up. There's been different marches, different events of support for the man down in Alabama as well as here. And, you know, we're always connecting around that. Again, since he did have his NFL experience, I've been trying to do what I can from the PA's basis to kind of bring some type of love, some type of recognition there, to do whatever we can to support the organization that they have in his memory and in his honor. And it's just... It's without getting too politically charged on the interactions of, you know, how the details of his eventual demise came about. It just I don't know. It's a glaring reminder of as much progress as we're positioning in today's conversations. At least we still haven't gotten too far from the fact that a Black man can lose his life in police custody in the South, and we're not going to get extended details. We're not going to have the inner workings of exactly what happened. Because as you know, and for people who eventually will listen to this who don't, Glenn was a very physically fit young man. He played nose tackle. He came in as a defensive end. But the boy probably... He had 10% body fat at 300 pounds.
Crazy.
He was good nature athletically.
Crazy.
And for it to come out that he had some cardiac event, or there's just it just still, like I said, I know we can't speak too much on the things, but it's like it's shocking not only that it happened to a person that are rich, that you still have questions about, just again knowing the physical standing of the man and hearing that that was, you know, the eventual cause of death. It's like something. It's just it's
A lot of questions, a
it's
lot of question marks.
it's yeah, it's a lot of questions, man. It's a lot of questions.
A lot of questions, bro. You know, I appreciate you sharing that and giving, and I wanted you to be able to give him that time and recognition. And I hope those who hear that can be able to kind of look it up and learn more about Glenn, man. And for those who are alums of U of I, who was around that time between 2009 to 2012, whatever, you can, whatever year, like just know, you know, you knew who he was. If you didn't know his name, you knew who he was. Where, you know, the Union, Searcy, at a frat house, it didn't matter. You knew who he was. So RIP to Glenn Foster and you know, praying for his family and everything. And so just, okay, so going back to you, and you kind of touched on it a little bit in terms of just the different identities in the locker room. But I want to know, when do you meet your first Black or African immigrant? When was the first time you, and what was the perspective that was told, like growing up in your community, about immigrants, Black African immigrants, or were you told something different than what you experienced, or like what was that like? What were your perceptions?
So I wouldn't say that, at least within my household, that I was told anything explicitly coming up. Obviously, we come from the 90s. We did not have a politically correct vernacular of the era, and everybody, no matter what culture you was, there was jokes for you.
Absolutely.
So everybody, you know those and you hear those and stuff like that. But I will say, at least I didn't think that, I know for a fact that within my own household, we were living here in Chicago, like I mentioned before we moved to Cleveland, and on our block, I remember specifically there was a Caribbean family. I hate that I don't know exactly what nation it was, because they always used to say West Indian back in the day. And we had three Black American families. And then I remember there was Elise singing, there was one across the street. They were all pretty much within our block. So you had that exposure there. And again, were people kind of factioned off and not as much interaction as, you know, now having the understanding of diaspora relations that I would have wished we had at the time. Yeah, of course not. But I would say at a very early age, probably, you know, like fourth, fifth grade, I knew that we had a family immigrated into the area. And again, it was just like, you know, just one of those things where it was like, you know, that's like, I wouldn't say like a divide, but it was just like, you know, it wasn't just really embracing like I would hopefully impart now and be able to do if I do have that, you know, opportunity to come into an immigrant family like that. You know, personally, not anything negative, but you know what it was like, man. You know what it was like, definitely. And it's unfortunate that we don't have the diaspora standing. I think that that's just due to, obviously, the systemic barriers that we have for, in America, anybody of, you know, any type of Black descent helping one another. There's that sense of selectivism. There can't be too much of us in one place. And that just breeds a whole lot of division in amongst Black Americans, amongst themselves, and everybody dang on else. So, yeah, man, we got to get past that as a whole diaspora.
Bro, absolutely, man. And so, you know, even going back to what you just talked about, and then we'll talk about just the locker room in the NFL. But, like, have you ever tried to – how far have you traced back your roots? I know you talked about your pops being St. Louis, your mom's being Chicago – and you talked a little bit about, like, you know, wanting to. So I want to know, have you taken any action as far as tracing your family roots all the way back to, you know, maybe Alabama, somewhere in the South, or even far back to Africa? Like, how far have you been able to trace your roots back?
Yeah. So obviously on different lines of my heritage, I've gotten back, I'll say, on my mother's side, at least like 7 or 8 generations I've been able to trace back. And then on my father's side, probably about 6. So I've been diligent about, while I still have my older generation, my grandparents' generation, to make sure that I ask as many questions as I can beyond, like in that era. Like I've have sat down both of my grandmothers and I'm like, look, I need to know everything. Who was your grandma? Who was her grandma? Like I need to know your granddaddy and all that stuff. So and then obviously since we're so close, it's crazy to think about it, but we're so close to segregation and then we're still so
So
close really to
yeah, to slavery.
enslavement that it's like I'm still, especially when I start tracing certain images, it directly becomes impactful of how far I'm able to get back. So I'm asking my grandmother questions on my father's side, about her grandfather and trying to chase back that paternal lineage that way. And it gets to the point to where, oh, I don't remember my grandmother's last name, or, I don't remember this person's name because they were, moved away and they were sharecroppers and they were in South Carolina, or, they immigrated and things like that. So, on my staple side, on my paternal lineage, I've been really fortunate that I've had elders, ancestors that have kind of thought in this space and been diligent about collecting this information, making sure that it's readily available. So, specifically, my aunt right before me, and then she's mentioned generations before her that have done the same work and kind of passed it on down to her. We've been having these conversations. We've been trying to, search out as much as we can, and luckily there was more complete records around some of the lineages, at least on that tree. But again, the fact that, sharecropping to come into play way sooner in the lineage that you would expect it impacts us in certain lineages being able to trace back. So done the same as well on my mother's side. But what happens is you start getting name switches and people not following paternal naming traditions. So now you having to look up through different names and seeing formulations on that whole side, especially with women not carrying their family's name into marriage. So that's muddied the waters there, but been able to trace, like I said, one lineage back at least about eight generations. And that's been great and it's given me great momentum to, luckily enough, right now in the position that I have with the NFLPA, we have a yearly trip to Washington, D.C. So every time I go out to Washington, D.C., I make sure I hit up the Smithsonian, the African American History Museum. And this last trip, I learned that they have ancestral root tracking that they've done and compiled and essentially positioned to where if you know far less information about your heritage than I have been able to, fortunate enough again, get passed down to me, they're able to start tracing those lineages for you through US Census records. And then they get further back beyond the US Census because, God, I forgot what year it was where the US Census stops. Because with my lineage, I think I got back into like finding an ancestor when he was born in like 1820s, somewhere up in there. And I think that's similarly where the census begins or ends. I forget exactly which year, but then beyond that, they have what's called the Freedmen Bank records, and the Freedmen is something with real estate, something with Freedmen real estate, like land transition or something along the lines. However, my point is that through those records, they're able to track transactions of property, aka enslaved Africans, to now further back into, get further than we ever were before into those lineages and start tracking. Okay, well, we can localize that if you had this pocket of your family that came from South Carolina with this last name, then here's maybe, 90% hit that this is your ancestor that was the first one that was enslaved or at least transitioned at this point, and from this plantation to that plantation. So now I'm making sure again that it's unfortunately it wasn't fully operational when I went this last time. But this year we go back in October and I'm headed straight there. That's
Oh
the first
man.
stop. And I'm getting deep into them records.
You gotta let
But
me
like I said,
know. You gotta let me know
yes, sir.
what you discover, man. That is amazing. That's an amazing resource and tool that this is the first I'm learning of it. So I would love to know. And I hope more people are able to utilize this as we as you know continues to grow. Yeah, man. So okay, so I think now, oh wait, are you the oldest sibling?
Yes.
Ish, so, right? Okay.
Right. I'm my father's oldest right. son, and then my stepmother on that side had a son that's 5 months older than me. So yeah.
Okay. No, just like the reason I was asking is because you know, like as an oldest son, there's also like culturally, at least from where I'm from, like there's responsibility. You know what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah,
so
big responsibility.
I understand, you know, that, and especially when you talk about like from a lineage standpoint and all that, and passing it on to your you know successors. It's important, but all right. So now in the locker room, as you got, you know, you got into the NFL, you know, you're with Cleveland and you go to Tennessee, and like, what does that look like in terms of, you know, athletes that are black or, you know, the African Americans, African immigrants, what is that dynamic like? And how did that work in the locker room? Because for me growing up, I see, you know, a lot of these players in the NFL, and I start to realize that slowly but surely, especially like it's taking off now. But when I was still like in undergrad and still watching the game as a shorty, like you see a couple of NFL players that were like Nigerian. Like there were only a few cities that had some like a real strong base of African players that were good. Chicago was one of them, especially with some of that, the 05-06 team and a little bit, you know, after that. Cleveland's another spot, even to this day, that still has it. Mm-hmm. You know, in Tennessee, not really-ish. Jacksonville kind of is, Atlanta kind of. But, you know, but I want to know what that experience was like from a, you know, from an intracultural standpoint as a black man. And was there a connection there? Was there a divide there culturally? Did Africans stick to themselves? Did African Americans stick to, what would that look like?
A lot of cohesion, a lot of love. Okay. I'll say definitely, like you said, we were in the era of the launch pad really to a lot of the now cultural positioning that we see within the NFL. You mentioned Cleveland, how JOK is culturally representing.
Doing it big too, yeah. Oh no!
They through his dress. Man, doing it huge. So speaking on my time in Cleveland, we had Chris Obanaya was in the room, and he was a locker room man, and he was mainly the one that would give us some of that cultural knowledge. You know, just stories from growing up, just coming up, and that's the thing that really bonds you. I think, you know, while you're in the locker room, those times, especially during camp. Man, you got 16-hour days. Yeah. So your whole day, literally outside of the hours that you're sleeping, you're around these men. So I will say that if the rest of the world and the rest of our diaspora interactions look like how they do in the locker room, oh, man, it set the world on fire just because there's so much love amongst each other culturally, especially, I mean, it's funny how when you're achieving the most that you ever have in your life, you're starting to feel that way. You know, it's that division is gone completely. You know, we see and are boosting one another and being able to uplift one another because we're walking into the space and the understanding that, you know, we will be perceived similarly, you know, at least amongst the American lens of, you know, racial makeup. So there is no division, man. There was nothing but love, nothing but support. It's where you're, you know, getting, again, that more cultural understanding of people's family at that point, you know, bringing the food in and doing all that type of stuff, man, and bringing it. They're like, I mean, I don't know. I think at that age, you're just kind of starting to cook more on your own and like kind of do things on your own and stuff like that. So it's a real bonding moment, I think. And again, man, if the rest of diaspora interactions could happen like that, we would be in a much more prominent position than where we are, you know, amongst ourselves. Yeah. And, yeah, it's something that is definitely assessment.
Yeah. And that's where the game, bro, it took me not by surprise, but it really fascinated me and made me very like happy, but also kind of felt like, wow, I started to get a little cynical when I started to see the taking off of the African influence in football. Right. Because again, right. A huge fan of, you know, I know it's been Osiom Inyora and, you know, Adewale Ogunleye who really kind of kicked this thing off, specifically Osi, and him bringing that NFL African kicking at Ziggy Ansah is also a big person. I remember him doing a couple things, bringing the NFL to Ghana and exposing some kids to that. And then now things, you start to see the NFL's created these pathways where they're bringing these international players from all over the world. But Africa now is starting to really be a huge contributor to people in these pathways to the NFL, where it's, you know, even the NFL roster, they create exemptions so that you don't, you know, when they have their cut days and they have an exemption where you're able to keep one of these players on your practice squad and they take up an extra spot if they've earned a spot, right? And so I'm starting to see the influence now, man. And even with the account being created, NFL Africa, you talked about JOK, who's doing his thing, right, in terms of that. But there are other players now that you're starting to see who are really pridefully, you know, showing the culture. I mean, people didn't even realize back in the day, like Nnamdi Asamoah, like, who was the cornerback from the Raiders and the Eagles, was a Nigerian, right? Like, I've talked about Jerry Azuma, right? I've talked about some other people. Huge player that Omobi Okoye, who was the youngest player at the time, being drafted in the NFL DT for Houston, Texas, and played for the Bears, right? I remember him, and I remember specifically him, like, him with an interview saying, like, he was 19 years old, and he was like, shit, like, okay, I'm gonna play the NFL, but I still got to go be a doctor. like I still have to go get my medical degree, right? Because that's just the expectations, right? Like, that was the expectation from his African parents, which is, you know, you still got to go get your medical degree. This is just for fun. Like, go get your degree is what we expected. We came to this country to get you, you know? And so it's just been fascinating to see the growth of it. And I want to know, like, and I'm hoping that there are more opportunities to bring more players to Africa. Right now, I just saw, like, I saw a tweet earlier today where they're bringing some kids from Ghana. You know, flag football is also a thing now, too. And they're bringing some kids from Ghana to Florida for, you know, an expose and regarding that. But so I'm wondering what your thoughts are, because a part of me is excited, but a part of me is also cynical because I'm like, this is cheap labor. Like, just, you know what I mean? So what are your thoughts, bro?
Facts, man. Definitely, you know, we got to toe the line. We got to watch it. Right. And that's why I love my position with the NFLPA. We always make sure that we're able to guard the protection of the athlete. So no matter where the athlete is going to be sourced from, there's always going to be a fight. There's always going to be something because this is a business and it's owners versus athletes. And that's what it boils down to when it comes to the collective bargaining agreements and when it comes to come to the table for those type of things. And yes, I think there is a issue when it comes to the treatment of the player when it comes in the football and, you know, the labor source, of course, just due to the physical nature of the game, which is why, again, I'm making sure their resources and benefits are accessible by film players and active players while they're involved in the game. And seeing where we're going with Africa, I support it, though. I support it because I will raise you the question, what's the alternative?
Oh, yeah.
The game must continue to grow. Yeah. As you mentioned, you know, we're fighting the battle still of, you know, being localized, only known as football here within the 50 states. Football still globally is what we refer to as soccer. So as we grow the game globally, because, I mean, it's here. I mean, in America, it's top sport. It's top. The numbers back that up when it comes to revenue. We're going to see it again yearly. The Super Bowl is the most highly paid for watch.
Highly viewed.
It's the highly viewed, man. It's the biggest generator of sports annually.
Yeah.
Obviously, the World Cup surpasses it, but that's a four-year event versus annually the Super Bowl is king. And since we can't grow it here, we're going to grow it globally. You see the efforts with NFL Europe going into London and throughout now Germany. This past year for the first time, Germany. And even thinking back to our era when there was the NFL Europe with the teams stationed there, there's going to naturally be an expansion. We have to get into more global markets. We have to get into large markets. And I don't want the opportunity to pass Africa. I know the generational wealth that can be created by the athlete.
Absolutely.
Therefore,
absolutely.
Yes, it's going to be a numbers game, and unfortunately, there's going to be a lot more who aren't successful than who are. However, for those who are able to, again, walk into this position of prominence at such a young age, you're creating generational wealth if you can stick around 5, 6 years, 4 years, depending on what situations you walk into. So the game needs to go there. The game needs to continue to expand. I want to grow the game as, you know, much as we can. We'll see here how it can grow globally. But man, it, the opportunity has to go there. It's too vast for it to not be presented to the motherland, because just athletically how it fits with the athlete that comes from, you know, we all come from the same bloodlines.
It's,
you
know, life changing,
you
bro.
Know, American born, being African born, it's still the same blood. Mm-hmm. And it's like you said, it's a life changing opportunity.
Yeah.
So I love what OC's doing. I love what we're doing to grow the game there. I can't wait till the day until we get an NFL game in Africa.
Ooh,
I
don't care.
As long as I'm breathing, I'm there.
Oh,
I'm there.
My God. I'm going. I can't wait.
I'm going. I've been watching. Man, I've been watching AFCON lately, mm-hmm. so soccer. I'm getting really big into soccer, obviously, now, just being older, just I love sports, and I can't lie, sports betting has gotten me into it.
Okay, okay, more, okay.
Just knowing there's so many opportunities just to view the game, and soccer specifically, man, but just seeing the, you know, the diaspora differences there amongst nations,
mm-hmm.
but then just the crowds of just blackness and cohesion like that, yes. man, it's awe-inspiring, and I can't wait till, again, like I said, I get my sport there, so I get my game there, because it's going to be something that can take it to another level of prominence.
Yeah, I agree completely. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, again, that's the cynic in me that questions, like, okay, what mm-hmm. is it? But I'm with you in terms of the opportunity, right? Like, this is that one person, no matter what, like, especially if we take into consideration inflation rates and all that, right? Like, the money you can get in the U.S. and you bring that back to the crib, right? You creating levels of generational wealth that can set you up. And so all you're looking for is the opportunity.
Societal
wealth, bro. And then, of course, right? Think about what you're bringing in. When you're starting to bring those Western influences to your country and what that can do in terms of the development of it, I bet you, I can almost bet you, bro, just because of what is happening right now, I could bet you that when that first NFL game does happen, it'll be in Ghana. Right. Just because of where Ghana is progressing in now. Right. Mm-hmm. And hopefully one day it'll be in Nigeria and beyond in South Africa. Mm-hmm. But like, bro, imagine seeing that. Right. And just being able to see like what it does and being able to have players from these countries be able to play, you know, in front of their peoples, a game that like it would be a beautiful thing. And especially being able to bridge. Right. I'm all about this podcast is all about bridging the gaps. Right. And acknowledging what they are, creating these bridges that allow you to go back and forth. Having the best of both worlds. And I do believe that being able to do that and create these transnational opportunities for you to be able to go here, play hard for your people, bring your family members over here, but also be able to take that back to your homeland and take care of your grandma, your extended family, those things, that is, that's a blessing beyond what it is, man. I definitely believe that, like, being able to create that pathway, it's just the beginning. This is just the door just being open. Once they start seeing what these athletes, because best believe me, wherever you think you find these dudes from, gifted, right? It's just in the blood, right? So once you start seeing the impact of these dudes, man, ain't no turning back. Ain't no turning back.
Ain't no turning back.
This ain't NFL Europe, man. Like, ain't no turning back. This is once you turn on that faucet, you let these guys in. the hustle, the grind, it's not going nowhere. They're gonna be there. Is your son going? You want your son to play football? Go ahead.
It's funny, bro. It's funny because it's a situation. So similarly, my mother saw what happened to my father and his transition out of the game. She didn't even let me play ball until I got into eighth grade.
See?
And I conned her into it because I kind of guilt tripped her. We had just moved to Cleveland the year before, and I'm like, I don't know nobody. You got to finally let me, because I have been trying to convince her since like second or third grade when I first started getting the organizational, you know, outreach from local teams and stuff like that, man. So I always said that, you know, I'm not going to push him directly towards that, especially at a young age, because the good thing about football is you don't have to take the hits in order to be great at it. Mm. So it's almost, from what we've seen and we talk in amongst guys, a lot of the guys that make it further is because, you know, they started taking the hits later. Mm. So many guys, see, you know, they start at Pop Warner and they're burnt out by the time they get to high school. Yeah. Like, they just play too much ball. Yeah. Like, it's, you know, we came up in the era where we were still playing, you know, tackle football with no pads before school and then go through a whole school day.
Yep.
But just the, as the sports science and nutrition aspects increase around the game, you're just going to create a bigger, faster, stronger athlete at a younger age. Mm-hmm. So to me, it's like, okay, we're going to start off with soccer. We're going to start off with gymnastics. We're going to start off with baseball. We're going to create hand-eye coordination. We're going to play basketball to be able to create good athletic stances and good defensive positioning and understanding of the geometry of sport because these type of things translate to football.
Yeah.
So when it comes time, if you want to pursue that, then, you know, we can look at that no earlier than high school, I think, for tackle football.
Okay.
Eighth grade, ninth grade, that's, it's funny enough, that's when I started playing, but I feel like that's really the sweet spot because, again, you can get the exposure, you can get the athletic standing that you need without taking those hits.
Yeah.
I was just talking with somebody about this recently. It's like, if I can teach you from basketball just what a good defensive stance is, you already got 80% of the battle of what you need on the defensive aspect on the football field. Because it's about maintaining that good athletic position and understanding zone concepts and positioning of team defense. You know, that's something that comes directly from soccer as well. Like this is, you can learn it in other places. And then when it comes time to play the game, if you still about that, if you still want to do it, then, you know, we can look at that at a later stage in life when your body's more physically ready to start taking hits and start delivering hits. So it's just like, I don't know. And it's funny because you look at the guys, I got former teammates down in Texas, and they got their 8-year-olds out there, man, fully suited and booted. They got, you know, the pre-game claps going. They got fireworks and all that stuff. And it's like, it's love to see, obviously, the game and the love for the game. But it's just like, I just don't know about the hits that, you know, it's like, if we can, you know, flag football it out up until, you know, eighth grade and stuff like that, then, you know, we'll be in a good position. The only thing that I will say, quarterbacks still, you got to learn how to throw the ball at a young age. So, yeah, if you're looking at that route, then maybe you got to start considering a little bit earlier in the game, man. But I don't know. When it comes to any of the physical aspect of the game, man, not before high school.
You know, that's I have friends who in here in the Midwest, at least, you know, they're going through the flag football route. And what you said of Texas, you know, Texas, that's culture, man. So I can't even charge that against them.
That's what I'm saying,
That's culture. That's part of their culture. That's a whole nother world. So just like from an NFL, like putting your chair presidential hat on, you talked about just the push and just fighting for people's rights. And I'm thinking about it for me from a public health standpoint. And I'm thinking about, all right, when we talk about access to resources, support, post-career health risk, especially when you play a game that is, you know, when you talk about the risk for concussions, right? And I think about, for me, right, as a young African immigrant, one of the reasons why, like, I had to, like, try to sneak and play football when it came to, like, my parents weren't going because of just, well, one, the lack of understanding of the game, and two, just the fear of whatever it is. And so what do you think about how things are now in terms of support for NFL players in post-career in terms of providing them resources and services to continue to, you know, have good health benefits? And two, like, how hard is that fight? Because one of the things that I learned, you know, as a sports fan is just that, for, especially with the NFL, when you're fighting players and owners, right, and you know, are, you know, you're debating, negotiating for, you know, the balance and fair resources and wages, and splitting the revenue, I should say. How difficult is it when there are no, like, star players, right? Like, for example, like the NBA has a lot of star power in their players association, right? Where in the NFL, it's not really like that. It's usually, you know, players who really care, like you, right? And who may not necessarily have the big multi-million dollar, you know, ain't set for life, you know. And you know how the NFL contract is. It's not always guaranteed. As a matter of fact, compared to other countries, it's not guaranteed. You know, and to have a sport that's so aggressively, you know, physical, and to not have that level of security, like, how hard is that fight when you don't have a lot of that superstar influence in the negotiation table, or at least leading the charge?
Yeah, so I will say we're at the best point, at least of what I've seen and what I've heard from stories of previous generations, that we have been on both ends of that question. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to getting better about having star athletic representation at the table for these conversations when it comes to, you know, CBA agreements, whatever the case may be, dealing with ownership, it's you getting guys. So now we have the structure, just to give you what we have with the NFLPA. We have a former player branch, but we also have an active player branch. So players amongst the 32 organizations, they're nominating their player rep. You have a player rep from each team that's there, and you have alternatives as well, if they're not able to act in the role, that are now doing the exact same thing. You know, bigger names are at the table doing it from that side. Guys that are on TV that do their work that you know as household names. And I'm thinking of a guy like Jason McCourty, for example, player rep, former rep, guy that's still doing great work on that side, speaking, you know, from the big name perspective. Austin Eckler has been great in this space, a few amongst others. And we're getting better about that, because more players, as again, the business of the game grows and the autonomy of the athlete grows as well, there's more of an understanding, there's more of that ownership to where, yeah, even with the big name guys who may get set, you know, with that first initial contract, they still see ways and things that can be fought for the guys to the left or right of them. So we're definitely progressing in that aspect, although that piece of it is more localized, is more internalized, it's not as broadcast as I believe it needs to be, which is by design for various reasons. When it comes to the resources and benefits as well, unfortunately, due to the pitfalls of previous generations, we've now gotten to the best point that we could when it comes to, you know, what plans are in place, how do you transition, you know, from your initial transition out of the league, that first year, the big mark that you need to be able to be at, and how you're going to get compensated for your time then, and then going beyond that, you know, at your five-year transition, making sure that guys know, you know, that transition to Cobra insurance and stuff like that, sure that that's even there for guys. It's something that, you know, wasn't there in previous years and previous generations. So they're all, we're always progressing the conversation. It's great to be at the table talking and seeing and knowing, you know, what's happening to the guys again, left or right of you, because then now we can make sure that it doesn't happen to the guys behind us. So there, we're making sure that that's progressive. We're making sure that, you know, every CBA, that there's the protection of the athlete at the forefront. This last argument was, I'm pretty sure, more for getting beyond even a 17-game schedule. We're trying to get to a 20-game schedule. I know in the ownership they have, they'd probably like to see 24. They would probably like to see, you know, higher frequency of the games, which is just not feasible for the structure. As you mentioned, you know, you have no guarantees. You have the, well, to a degree. And then you have, you know, the hard salary caps. It's just so many things that to where now all the downfalls want to come onto the athlete themselves. So, yeah.
We increase the risk of injury every game. That's crazy.
Without increasing the risk of, without increasing the amount of protection that's around the athlete, you know, post the game especially. So, yeah, we're at a great point, brother. And it can always get better. It's going to continue to get better. The major fight, of course, is always going to be for, you know, lifelong healthcare. You mentioned how rough the sport is. And we're still at a point where, unfortunately, the main downfall of the game is CTE, as we all know, and just knowing the chronic traumatic encephalopathy and what that can do to the neurocognitive degeneration in your brain. And we still can't diagnose it until a person is deceased and the brain can be dissected and you can pull the chemical and figure out what was going on there. But we keep progressing the safety around the game. We keep making sure that, you know, the safety checks are there, the conditioning of helmets, the science of helmets themselves keep progressing every single year. Guys out there, like, for example, George Kittle's helmet. I absolutely hate the way the dang old helmet looks, but I'm pretty sure there's so much science behind it and the exact shape. And it's nuts when you're getting these fittings. Even I can think from back to when I was playing, you know, from 2013 to 2017 in the league, knowing what that was like then. Now we're 7 years beyond that. It just keeps progressing because you're seeing it. You're seeing those shock collars now that guys wear in order to decrease that same, that impact on your head and neck area. And it's good that, you know, these conversations are directly leading to, you know, positive protection around the playing at the current athlete, the active athlete, and the former athlete as well. So it's not perfect. Of course, we're continuing to fight for, you know, overall protection of the athlete, but we're at the best point, I think, man. Again, like I said, just due to what's happened to previous generations, it's about guarding against, you know, what happened to them well before us.
Yeah. So this is something I've always been curious about. So I'm going to have you answer this because I might forget this question. But like, what happens with cut players? Right? Like what type of role does the NFL PA have with like with cut players from like, for example, you may not be vested, you may not be 5 years in, you know, I'm talking to like BJ Bello, but I'm gonna have to have BJ on too. But like just being, if you're within that 5 year, 1 to 3 year mark and you get cut from training camp or you get, you're a cap casualty, whatever the case may be, you know, what is the Players Association role, you know, for that? What does that look like? In terms
that's
of support.
That's exactly what we're here for.
Okay.
Literally for the zero year guy on through, you know, under, it takes 3 years, 3 credits to get vested. And then you start accruing credits and stuff like that after that, beyond that. But for those 0 to 1 year guys, especially, there are services that are directly directed towards that basis of athlete that is only accessible to them. So that's something that I said that, again, because of previous generations, to your point, you know, people falling by the wayside due to, well, a multitude of reasons, they would kind of get forgotten about. You know, you only focus around the household names because these are the ones that are tenured, the ones that, you know, are the business generator and the ones that just naturally, you know, generate the most attention internally as well. So the PA has done a great job, again, about making sure certain, you know, continuing education resources are there for 0 to 1 year guys, business transition pieces are there, and access to things that are still sport specific, training. We have different checkpoints, BU immediately out the year, and then we have entity that checks in and does what we call a wraparound your first calendar year outside of an active contract. And it's about, again, bringing the player down, doing a health and wellness check, a brain and body assessment, pursuing continuing education based on what field that you may want to enter, real estate, business, finance, whatever the case may be. A bunch of other things, man, that goes on there to, again, help with that transition that's unique with, okay, man, you specialized in a sport for so long. You were fortunate enough to make it as a professional, but now you have to have the foray into the working world. So, you know, what's going on here, you know, here are the ins and outs of what you need to be prepared for. Here's, you know, training, sales coaching, and all this other type of stuff that may help you along the way. Mm-hmm. So, the PA is the one and the entity that's putting its own arms around those guys and that player. Because from the organization standpoint, again, unless you hit certain criteria, certain marks, then, you know, it's a yearly game. It's a harsh game with it being only a 53-man roster. There's going to be a lot of turnover, especially when you're housing 90-man rosters and you have to whittle down to 53. And that's just a yearly occurrence, let alone what's going to happen throughout the course of the year, injuries, all that stuff, man. It's so funny because people start asking you certain things like, you know, what team do you root for and stuff? Or, you know, just asking you, like, you know, from fan pieces of the game. But it's like, man, so many of us played with each other. So many of us played for multiple organizations and stuff like that. I'll catch myself wearing Browns and Titans stuff at the same time. And people look at me like I'm crazy. And I'm just like, bro, like, it's like if you knew it, it's like it's one big family. On Sundays you have a division, but it's one big body.
It's one fraternity.
That, you know, yes, the colors are changing. And exactly, it's a fraternity. It's exactly what it is. So, and the PA is the arm, again, that makes sure that if you only sign, we literally have services for a person that signed essentially what would amount to a one-day contract. You could have got signed, you could have got cut the same day. Mm. If you were on that 90-man roster and it was printed, then there's something that the PA can do for you and make sure that, you know, you get some type of embrace going into, you know, the transition that you're about to face.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. That's, for me at least, to some degree, that's comforting, right? Because I had asked that question simply because I think based off what we just discussed in terms of where the NFL is headed, right? And especially it becoming more global, and we're talking about these pathways. And so I think about that particular African immigrant player, that international player that's coming from the motherland. And if that person gets cut, what are they, you know, what are they subjected to? What type of opportunity? So I'm also thinking like your offices, your organizations now are going to become more expansive and a global reach. I'm excited about that for you. Yeah. And, you know, like the global reach is going to become even more because now y'all are going to be, you know, really reconnecting and building these relationships with these, you know, African brothers and these African immigrants and these other people from all over the world. And that in itself is going to be important as far as how you all are able to develop support for them. So, know, I'm curious to see what that looks like for you in the future, bro.
Like you said, man, that expansion piece is going to be amazing. We already have our national office out in D.C., so we're going to have an international office, and that just breeds opportunity. So, again, there's transition right there. That's an economy that's being built, that's business that's being directly, you know, generated for the athlete. And the great thing about this, it's by the athlete. So many former players house and operate in these positions, and it's just like, man, there's going to be something there for you. And it's just an amazing opportunity, brother. See, I can't wait. Like you said, man, that expansion is going to be, I can't wait for the day.
Yeah, me too, bro. So my last question for you, just because of time, man, this has been a nice long conversation, but I got to get you back to your family. but I want to know, and I always ask this, especially, so you can answer this from a, you know, from your standpoint right now, in your profession, but also just in general, personally, what do you want your legacy to be? And that's important because, again, you've talked about these things being personal, right? And so I want to know what do you want your legacy to be overall, personally and professionally?
Man, that's such an open-ended question to where I could take that for a whole nother hour in and of itself, man. I could take it for a whole nother hour in and of itself. But, man, I think it boils down to what we're all striving to be known as, you know, husband, father, friend, like that one that I don't want to be the one that has to change his spots based on what room I'm walking into and not be able to be able to do that and still be able to embrace, you know, everyone that's in the room, being able to know that, you know, I'm someone that's working for those that are around me is something that's always been at the forefront. Man, just something that's very important to my core. Just values there, man. And especially when it comes to the fatherhood piece in the aspect as well, just wanting to have a different understanding through my personal actions of what Black fatherhood looks like. We know, especially us that have had positive relationships with our fathers, what it feels like and what it does for your persona, especially as a man. And it's something that I think that we know and we can feel, and it's not put at the forefront. It's not conveyed enough to the rest of society, the true power behind Black fatherhood. And I want to be at the forefront of that, having that as a part of my legacy, just knowing that it boils beyond your own personal family. You know, it's about being a safe space for Black manhood, and something that if you're able to steward that change, we know what's been so, you know, negatively positioned in media and the connotations around stuff, and to be a part of the generation that could change that, man, if I could have any piece of that, that's something that I think the legacy would speak for itself then. And that's why I'm so, you know, prone to continue to operate organizationally how I do with NFLPA, with Omega Psi Phi, and being in my grad chapters and doing the things that I can in order to make sure that I'm helping people that look like me, man. That's something that when other communities do it, it's not known as a taboo thing or something that we get the differing, you know, connotations on working together. And I want to make sure that, you know, we're a part of that change, that societal change, that, you know, too much warring, being in any room that's bringing Black men together, no matter where, what part of this globe that we were born on, you know, there's been too much warring. And I think that that's something that is obviously systemically positioned, is something that's benefits and generates a certain narrative. And to be a part of the generation that can dispel that, it'll just permeate, I think, you know, for eons, man. It's just something that we can be intentional about, and I want that to be a part of my legacy, making sure that, you know, I'm influential in my community. We are just fortunate enough to be your people that, you know, have prominence just coming from you about the just the things that we've been able to achieve and stuff like that, man. And just really being able to walk in that purpose is something that I think that when you do that and you have these things at the forefront, the legacy will write itself.
Yeah, no, that's well said. I appreciate you taking the time. There's so much we could have covered. We could have talked for hours and hours because I could have asked you so much questions, especially from a sports standpoint. But I have to remember, this is not a sports podcast. This is more so about culture and identity. So I want to, of my questions, I'm going to ask you offline. But, bro, I just want to take the time again. I know you're busy. You got a lot going on. You got a lot of responsibility. First and foremost, I just want to thank you for your time. Secondly, I want to just on air just share with you how proud I am of you, of the man you were when I met you in that classroom. Me and TJ, we was in that classroom, that cultural communication classroom, and seeing you while you were pledging, right? You know, doing your thing, still handling business, and what you've evolved to as a leader, as a teammate, as a brother, as a father, and what you're trying to do as a steward, you know, for others, bro. It is, you are an exemplar model for other young men. And so I hope that more people continue to seek you and use you as, you know, a quintessential example of what it is to be, you know, a really, really a good Black man, bro. And that is, you know, that is something that I'm proud to be associated with brothers like you, man. I thank you for the time. And you know, here we wish you nothing but success and whatever we can do to support what you're doing with the NFLPA. I already told you, I'm with you. Whatever I can do to get this thing going, because I know what the intentions is, what the intentions are for what y'all trying to do, not just for the players, but also for the community, for young players, young kids coming up. You don't got to be an athlete, but just young kids coming up looking for opportunities and role models. So please let us be a resource and a facilitator for y'all. But yeah, bro, again, just, and I'm very excited for what the future holds for you and the family and everything that y'all got going. So, yeah, man, just nothing but love, bro.
Likewise, brother. I appreciate that, man. Much gratitude. I feel humble, man. And definitely iron sharpens iron when it comes to that aspect, man. Really proud of everything. The growth, like I mentioned, man, from that classroom to now seeing everything that you've been achieving on your doctoral path, yeah. and still being connected to the mission, speaking for people from your position, segueing into this country, you know, for the first time and stuff like that, and being able to still keep connections to, you know, those of us who are here helping us get back to our roots, brother, is something that, again, man, it's going to speak for generations, the work that you're doing, man. And I couldn't be proud of being associated with you myself. So
thank you,
man. Love, nothing but love, brother. Mm-hmm. Definitely gonna make sure we stay in touch. This is the first of many conversations
absolutely
we're able to have in this forum.
Absolutely.
And being able to keep this thing going, brother.
Yeah absolutely, man. Looking forward to, you know, bringing more brothers on, having good forums about, you know, the diaspora, but also I think as we get to this age, fatherhood, right? Like, so I'm looking forward to talking about all those important things with you, man. So yeah, man, how can anybody, you know, follow you, learn more about what you're doing, the work, if you want to share any information for contact, you know, where can we get in touch with you?
Yes, sir. Really big and active at this age on LinkedIn. Obviously, my name, Justin Staples. You can find me on there. That's where I post all my professional moves, all the NFLPA stuff will be there, as well as Instagram, Twitter. You can find me at J_Staples57. Again, that's where I'll post a lot of those moves, but you'll get a further glimpse into me, as, you know, the overall person and some of the things that we have going on, you know, with the fam. Always got big moves going. So, those are the main channels that you can find me. And, beyond that, man, I'm in these streets of Chicago. Come see us.
In these betting streets, these betting streets, man.
Betting streets out here, brother.
Yeah.
Betting streets.
Yeah, man. Hey, Justin Staples, man, the first, man. Thank you so much for jumping on the show, bro.
All love, brother. Appreciate you having me.
So that's going to do it for this episode of My Black is Transnational. If you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, subscribe, and review the podcast. You can learn more about this podcast by visiting our website at blacktransnational.com. You can follow me, the host, at blacktransnational_ on Instagram, or you can follow the podcast at Black Transnational Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. So, until next time, my name is Dr. Kalechi Bay Lamberts. My Black is Transnational, and I hope by the end of this, yours will be too. Peace.